continue on with our look at the Reformation and Martin Luther. And I started to say Martin Luther, the man, the myth, the legend. It is interesting, though, when you think about the story of Martin Luther, there are many, or there are at least several things in the life of Martin Luther, in sort of the story or the narrative of Martin Luther, that have been retold and recounted many, many times over in biographical works, in film, in TV, I'm sure in theatrical productions. This monumental figure certainly is responsible for, in many ways, monumental shifts that we experience today, that we feel the benefits of, that we feel the ramifications of, even in our day and time. So it stands to reason that there would be a lot of things written about this person, a lot of things said. As is often the case, however, and as we are often inclined, we are bent toward drama. We are inclined toward the fantastic. And so some of the lore around Martin Luther tends to lead people to maybe, I don't want to say misconstrue intentionally, but maybe not really have a full sense of the picture of Martin Luther and his life, and really, more importantly, the providential work of God to bring about his purpose in using a vessel like Martin Luther. We are often inclined, as you know, to idolatry in our flesh, and we are inclined to the sort of the elevation of men as representatives of something great and grand, even at times to our own detriment, or even at times to, I guess, the detriment of a true sort of theological understanding of the workings of God in the world and throughout history. And I think that Martin Luther certainly is one of those figures that can be looked upon either with a certain element of drama, because there were some dramatic things that took place over the course of his life that were markers that we all feel the ramifications of even today, but also this tendency to maybe look upon a man and not really look past the man to see the work of God accomplishing his purpose, his word never returning void, him, according to what Christ said in Matthew, building his church. Nothing will prevail against that work. And really, by virtue of seeing that, enabling the redeemed believer to rejoice once again in the sovereign work of God amongst his people, both now and in the past and throughout history and on into the future until Christ comes, and even beyond. So I want to kind of take the time today to bring about some more tactile reality to some of the early years of Martin Luther. Of course, you probably, if you've had any exposure to any Reformation history, then you probably know some of the seminal moments in the life of Martin Luther. I keep wanting to say John Calvin, we're not there yet. Of Martin Luther. You may have heard the account of the famous thunderstorm that he was riding his horse in and headed back to Erfurt, where he was at university. And he was, in a sense, dramatically thrown from his horse by a lightning strike. And at that point, cried out for help to Saint Anne and committed to become a monk if she would help him. And of course, the point that sent him to the monastery instead of into his legal studies. Probably heard something along those lines. You certainly, as we talked about a little bit last week, you certainly are familiar with the October 31st, 1517 event. The dramatic, with a gigantic hammer and a big nail, nailing the theses to the wall. We talked about that last week. It probably wasn't a giant hammer and a big nail. And it was really just a posting, inviting people to a debate. But nevertheless, a seminal moment is one of those moments that's looked back historically as this was a big, big deal. And so oftentimes it's easy to kind of maybe over-dramatize what actually happened. It's funny, a little side note, but you know the movie 1917, right? We went to see that. I keep calling it 1517. I've got that date stuck in my head. So, yeah, I had to kind of remind myself. But of course, you know, the posting of the 95 Theses to the door of the Wittenberg Chapel is another one of those moments. Of course, the Diet of Worms in 1521, where he takes his stand in front of the emperor, the Holy Roman Emperor of the Holy Roman Empire, and the Pope, and all the magistrates and clerics that were gathered there, and he took that famous stand where he cried out. He didn't cry out, but he basically stated, "My conscience is held captive to the Word of God," and among other things, that was kind of this point where he was calling upon them, please show me where I'm wrong according to Scripture. But until then, I cannot recant. My conscience is held captive to the Word of God. So you have these dramatic moments. I mean, when you retell them, when you go back and you read some of the quotations of Luther himself, or when you just think about it from a historical perspective and it representing this massive turning point, it's pretty dramatic. I mean, it weaves together a pretty dramatic story. But there was life before those events, right? And so I want to kind of take a look at some things that were, I think, very seminal and developmental in Martin Luther and what God used in his providential working of things in ways that at the time probably weren't points of awareness. I gave you a teaser of that last week when I told you about Saint Martin, who Martin Luther is named after, and how he basically took a stand in Worms himself centuries before because he did not want to go to battle and take a human life, and so he took a stand in that same city, and that's who Martin Luther was named after. So we'll look at some of those kinds of things that really were just the way that God works in and through normal everyday life. This is another important point, that we tend to kind of have these people that we look at and we put them on a pedestal, but we also, in some ways, diminish what we could accomplish or how God might use us in some strange way. I mean, that's them. That's what they do. And in reality, what they have accomplished is nothing but walking faithfully in the Lord, using circumstances, the influence of other people, life events, and them walking faithfully and the Lord using them and using their gifts just like he would anyone else who is seeking to do the same. So let's look at some of the early years. There's not a lot of detail about Luther's early years. We know that he was born on November 10th, and as we said last week, probably in the year 1483, although it's not certain. We even talked about how his mom didn't even really know the year he was born, including him. He didn't know the year he was born, but the sound estimate is November of 1483 in Eisleben, Germany. His father was apparently a very successful miner, copper miner, owned some smelting businesses, and had always wanted Martin to go to university, ultimately go to university, pursue a study in law, a course in law, and then come back and work in the family business and have just a successful sort of family life and business life. That was sort of his father's aspirations for him. Don't have a lot of information about Martin Luther's first 18 years, but we do have things that are at least indications of those early years, namely that his early days of school were not the most enjoyable for him. In fact, they were in some ways treacherous. Eric Metaxas, in his book on Martin Luther, says this: Luther's recollections of his earliest years come to us almost exclusively from the much older Luther. From his marriage in 1525 until his death in 1546, Luther and his wife Kathy lived in the former Augustinian cloister called the Black Cloister, where they took in a number of student boarders and had frequent guests. At some point, it became acceptable for some of these boarders and guests, the students especially, to record much of what Luther said. These notes filled many volumes and came to be known as table talk. Probably have heard that reference. Of course, there's Ligonier has a magazine called Table Talk Magazine. It's based upon this type of taking down of the things that Luther said kind of around the table. They often contain several versions of the same anecdote or statement as recorded by more than one participant, so that it can be confusing to sort them out. Furthermore, Luther's mature recollections have more than a little editorial English on the ball and must be understood as an often irascible older man making particularly sharp point about an event from decades earlier rather than as a simple and placidly indifferent recounting of history of historical facts. So you can see Luther in his older years sitting around the table. And by the way, he was known as this somewhat mischievous, sarcastic sort. And so you can imagine his older years sitting around the table and people judiciously taking down every word he said and him probably wishing that that didn't happen in every case. But so a lot of the things you have from his early years kind of come from this source. And so it has to be kind of sifted through to kind of try to determine what would be sort of representative of good historical data to report on. Metaxas goes on to say, given these caveats, we may nonetheless say that Luther's reminiscences of his school days are not at all fond ones. For example, he says that one morning during his earliest years at school, he was thrashed 15 times for failing to conjugate and decline a certain Latin verb. Those are the good old days of teaching right there. Thrashed 15 times because he got the conjugation of the Latin verb wrong. I was kidding. That's not the good old days. Anyway, Luther explains it was a verb the class had not yet been taught and was therefore not obliged to know, so the errors made that day were only the teachers in administering these now immortalized quindecimal hidings. But even in a treatise in 1524, he already spoke of having, quote, learned less than nothing despite all the floggings, trembling, anguish, and misery, end quote. So that's his description of his younger school days. Wasn't a happy time. One gets the general impression that childhood for an exceedingly sensitive and intelligent boy such as Martin Luther must have been an endless fear-filled trial from which he could hardly wait to escape. So younger years filled with fear. It's also interesting to note and also consider and think about, and this becomes, I think, important when you're looking back at the life of Martin Luther and others of that time. The sort of the vision of God was an ominous vision. The vision of life and mortality and life after death was ominous and fear-filled. So you can imagine, you think about how young children develop in their understanding and their cognitive abilities and their abilities to grasp and understand and wrestle with more abstract ideas. And you're holding forth this vision of God and this vision of judgment and punishment and law and the means of grace that are purely your ability to fulfill these requirements. I mean, it puts this heavy burden of an ominous nature. Plus, you think about the time and the era and the physiological realities, the mortality rates, the onslaught of the plague that was taking life in sweeping fashion. I mean, death and the fear of death and uncertainty about the afterlife and uncertainty about standing before a holy God, these were very heavy weights to bear. And so that was also something that riddled Martin Luther throughout his life, and I'm sure those seeds were planted very deeply even in these early years. Later in life, Luther described the general atmosphere of fear of authority at school as something that became chronic throughout all of life, so that even when someone meant him well, he could hardly conceive of it. Luther said that the irrational and ignorant fear of a good God was what perpetuated, that was perpetuated by the churches and theology of that time was connected to this. So that's kind of the point. Now, from there, from his early years of school, he made his way to a town called Magdeburg, about the age of 13, in the fall of 1496, or possibly the spring of 1497. They sent him to this school, about 40 miles north of his home, again at the age of 13, living with a group called the Brethren of the Common Life while he was there in Magdeburg. He was placed with this group. They were not an official monastery or monastic order, but they were very pious. They were a very disciplined order, and they kind of had a monastic-type community and a monastic-type lifestyle. They lived in relative poverty, not abject poverty like some of the other monastic traditions endorsed. But still, they lived in poverty. They made their living by copying books because the printing press wasn't yet common. It was probably here that Luther was first exposed to this kind of piety, this kind of devotion, this kind of sort of Christian commitment that was fleshed out in these pious kinds of ways of living and viewing life. And so it certainly would have had some influence on him at this time. There was another influence during this period of time in Magdeburg when he was a young boy. And again, he was only there for 1 year, so from the age of 13 to the age of 14, this 1 year period of time. There was a man named Prince Wilhelm of Anhalt that was there in that town. And he came from a very religious, very wealthy, prominent family. In fact, both of his brothers became priests and his sister became a nun. And so this Prince Wilhelm did not want to be outdone, so he took orders as a Franciscan monk and basically sort of one-upped him. So you're going to just be a priest? Well, I'm going to be a Franciscan monk. We're going to go full-on monkery. So he formally dedicated himself to this life of poverty and renouncing all of his claims to title and to wealth and to the privileges of being a part of this titled family and all the, you know, he would inherit his father's principality of rulership and authority, and he just set all that aside and took the orders of the Franciscans, set aside all of his worthy riches. And so this person was known in the town. And he was influential in his wanderings throughout the town. Again, Metaxas says this: Wilhelm's severe presence on the streets of Magdeburg at that time must have been affecting. In the mendicant Franciscan fashion, he went about with a sack on his back. He was also known to be assiduous in performing tasks in the monastery. And his endless vigils and fasts, along with the self-flagellation that was current at the time, ultimately reduced him to a walking skeleton. He died in 1504 while only in his mid-40s. That Wilhelm had so utterly forsaken the trappings of this world, even those of a prince, could not have failed to captivate the sensitive young man, Luther, whose extraordinary introspection, as would be so powerfully evidenced in later years, would place a powerful check on the worldly ambitions his father had carefully planned for him. And when you get further into the context of Luther's life and you begin to see how he conducts himself in his early period of life as a monk, as he changes courses from the study of law and heads to the monastery, you'll see echoes of the actions and the descriptions of this Prince Wilhelm, who took the orders of the Franciscans and basically abased himself, even to the point where it probably contributed to his early demise. Luther even wrote about this man. He said, "With my own eyes, I saw him carrying the sack like a donkey. He had so worn himself down by fasting and vigil that he looked like a death's head, mere bone and skin. No one could look upon him without feeling ashamed of his own life." So that's Luther's own testimony of the influence and impact of seeing this man and his self-abasement for the sake of piety. This self-denial, extreme self-denial, under the rubric of faithfulness to Christ. This is what it should look like. And so this was what he was representing as a Franciscan monk. Well, by age 14, so you just kind of keep thinking about these influential people and environments that Luther was walking in, and you begin to start looking ahead to this moment where he's thrown, you know, in fear in a thunderstorm later in life. It wasn't like he was just tootling along his way and then a thunderstorm came and he's like, okay, I'll become a monk. There's the God is using different events in his life, different real circumstances and real people to build in him a certain frame of mind and to use all these things sovereignly and in providence for the purpose that he had. And this story sort of continues. He goes from this particular town to Eisenach at age 14. Eisenach had three monasteries, like prominent monasteries there, the Dominicans, the Carthusians, and the Franciscans. They were all there. There were three parishes, large parishes in Eisenach: St. Nicholas, St. George, and the foundation of St. Mary. Again, Metaxas says this: "The capacious church of St. Mary had 20 altars, and innumerable relics, the most remarkable of which was a bone fragment from St. Mary herself. Pilgrims to that shrine believed they were gazing upon a sanctified chunk of the very arms that held the infant Jesus." So this impact of relics and of sacred artifacts, that if you would go and make pilgrimage to them, you would receive some kind of blessing, some kind of indulgence, some kind of remission of sin. In other words, this probably fake relic that people would swarm to St. Mary's there where he was in school at age 14, and him seeing that would have a significant impact on him. In fact, Luther later called the city of 4,000, a population of 4,000, quote, a nest of priests and an emporium of clergy. So it was significant impact on his outlook of the church. He attended the parish school of St. George while he was there. He was there about 3 years. He through some connections, he came to meet and begin to live with a very prominent family there called the Schalbe family. I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing that right in German, but the Schalbe family, S-C-H-A-L-B-E, so however you pronounce that in German. Now, he lived with them for several years. This family was not only prominent, but they were also very pious, and in fact, they taught Luther that God must be at the center of your life, and they also influenced him to begin seeing that it's possible that there might be a gap between the way the church actually functions and the way God might intend the church to actually function. So just living with this prominent family, kind of like, you know, you're going to do a missionary retreat somewhere and you just get a host home and you stay with them for a while and you start to have conversations getting to know them, and they begin to have this influence on him. I mean, it's that real-time, real-life, day-to-day kind of thing that begins to sort of plant a seed in his mind to begin to view the church and be maybe critical of it, or to maybe see that there might be some daylight between this is the church and this is what God intends the church to be. There might be a gap here. And so this family, just a they were committed to, like, for example, the Franciscan order. I mean, not, they weren't Franciscans, but they were patrons of the Franciscan order, the Franciscan monastery. So they were seeking to be faithful within the structure, but they were also wrestling with these things as well to some degree, to the extent that it somehow, you know, led to them having conversations that influenced Luther to you know, these little seeds, you know, these little points of reference, these little seeds that bring about a certain bent of thought and ultimate influence down the way. It was also considered likely that through this family, Luther would have heard of a Franciscan monk named Johannes Hilton, who at that time, when he was in Eisenach, was imprisoned in a monastery there for his criticisms of the church. And he also had some apocalyptic prophecies that he wrote about that were considered crazy. But one of the prophecies, Metaxas writes about it, he says, Hilton predicted in his apocalyptic writings that a man would arise in the year 1516 who would fight to reform the church and who would succeed and who would end the centuries-long reign of the monks. We do not know whether Luther was aware of Hilton's writings at this time, but we do know that in the years ahead, Luther would indeed identify himself as that figure Hilton had prophesied. So again, these other little things, you know, that just tie together to bring about sort of influence and information about how his thinking might have been informed as he was just living his life and pursuing at that time what he thought was a course in study of the law, ultimately, according to his father's dreams. Again, during this period of time, as he was at this point in his life, from age 14 to 17, this was a period of time, it was kind of maybe the height of papal corruption, just really bad papal corruption at this particular time. So he was exposed in some way to that kind of environment, that scene, what was really going on with the papacy. To give you an example, the Pope in Rome during this period of time in Eisenach was Alexander VI. He's considered to be possibly the most depraved of all the popes. When his predecessor, Innocent VIII, died, and rather than him lobbying for the papacy like was the custom, he just bought it. He literally bought it with cash. So he purchased his way into the papacy. He was a cardinal at the time. And he just basically leapfrogged everyone else with cash and paid for the golden throne of the papacy. When he was a cardinal, prior to becoming the pope, he fathered 7 illegitimate children. After he became pope, he used the power of the pen of the papal bull and declared those illegitimate children legitimate, and then proceeded to place them in various places of influence within the church and in civil society. He also, just prior to buying the papacy, he took a mistress who continued to be his mistress after the papacy. He was at the age of 59. His mistress was 16. So this is the Pope we're talking about here. And here's the interesting note about this, or another interesting note about this. And again, this is Luther in this environment. You've got all these other things kind of bringing about influence. But it was also this particular Pope Alexander that the two of his successors, Sixtus V and Urban VIII, described Alexander as one of the most outstanding popes since St. Peter. So you can just kind of imagine if you're someone who's sort of being prompted in certain areas and provoked in other areas, and you're yet dealing with this tremendous introspective fear of death and the unknown of the afterlife and the uncertainty of the system that you're in, and yet the certainty of it at the same time. And yet you're also observing, and by this time, the corruption of the papacy was well known. It was understood by most. It was just sort of like a thing. So it wasn't like this was some kind of hidden situation. It wasn't kind of like it was, the general population was just, it was veiled from them. It was just sort of the way it was.
So was the vow of celibacy in place at this point, or did that come later?
Well, of course it was in place, but okay. There are always exceptions. yes, it was. So again, another sort of environmental set of circumstances that would have certainly bearing or influence on Luther. From there, he made his way to the university at Erfurt, which is probably, the place that most people are familiar with. This is where he began his university studies at age 17. This was sort of a culminating step in this educational journey. Again, his father's dream was that he would pursue a study in law and work, and he worked hard to provide for his son. I mean, he was sort of a successful merchant, if you will, a miner, but he wasn't like extravagantly wealthy. He was sort of like a middle to upper middle class kind of living. His parents are often believed to have been peasants, and at times Luther references them as peasants, but it was sort of like a rhetorical device compared to, the extravagance of the aristocratic class, or even those in the clergy. It was a comparative kind of reference. But they worked hard. His dad worked particularly hard to provide for him. Luther even reflected upon this later on when he said, "My dear father maintained me there at Erfurt with loyal affection, and by his labor and the sweat of his brow enabled me to go there." There's also some data out there that would indicate that Luther had a bad relationship with his father. His father was onerous and basically was a big contributor to his fear and anxiety before a holy God, and his dad was sort of the conduit of all that. And that's really not an accurate reflection of that relationship. And there's many, many things in Luther's record that would indicate his affection for his father and his appreciation for his father and the way his father provided for him. While at Erfurt, he engaged in tremendous academic and religious disciplines that had significant influence over him. This is where he really began to shine. His brilliance began to shine forth. Not until this point. It was sort of average to above average, but at this point, his intellect began to be well recognized and respected. Some of the disciplines that they would engage in: students woke up at 4 a.m. for devotions. They lived in a residential hall, of which there were six at Erfurt. They'd take two meals per day, the first at 10 a.m. after 4 hours of exercises and lectures. So get up at 4 and don't eat or anything until you've done 4 hours of exercises and lectures and study and devotions. After the first meal, there were more exercises and lectures until 5 p.m. Luther seems to have been in the Heaven's Gate Bursa, which is the place where they lived. where the entire Psalter, the entire Psalms, were prayed through every 15 days during the early morning devotions. The entire Psalms prayed through every 15 days. So he certainly would have become familiar with the Psalms, if nothing else, right? During both meals of the day, the students listened quietly as someone read aloud passages from the Latin Vulgate Bible. So again, very rigorous, regimented, academic and religious study disciplines that were employed at the school in Erfurt, at the University of Erfurt. Historian says sometimes the Postillae of Nicholas of Lyra were also read aloud. These were exegetical Bible commentaries of which Luther thought so well that he praised them highly many years later, and when he was writing on the book of Genesis, he used them extensively. It's therefore only logical to assume that Luther was at this early age deeply affected by what he heard. This must have been one important factor that impelled him to consider matters of God far more than the average Erfurt philosophy student. And we cannot doubt that even if he had never thought of it before, he would during these years first have begun considering the idea of a life in holy orders. So again, this thunderbolt, lightning strike kind of conversion that was just sudden and had no precedent or no seeds or anything like that is not really an accurate reflection of the historical record. As I said, his brilliance was really shining there at Erfurt during this period of time. After only three semesters, he earned his baccalaureate degree, passing his exams in 1502. And then he began his master's studies. This is when his talent really began to shine. Actually, students called him, quote, the wonder of the whole university. So he was certainly gaining recognition as a brilliant mind. He passed his master's exam in January of 1505 at about the age 21. So that kind of gives you the track of his historical record. And now it's time for him to pursue his legal studies. So this is where this is the culminating moment of sort of the path of him honoring his father and actually pursuing a course for employ and for building a life back in his hometown and that kind of thing. Receiving his master's had a tremendous impact on him, though. It was a great accomplishment, both for him and for his family. So he was now ready to begin this final march, as I said. But we know that during this point in time, it wasn't, even though he was this accomplishment of this master's was significant, and he even sort of celebrated it later on in life. He actually said later on in life, "What a moment of majesty and splendor was that, when one took the degree of master, and the torches were carried before, and honor was paid one. I consider that no temporal or worldly joy can equal it." So it was a very sort of uplifting and inspired time for Luther to achieve this. But it was also a time of great difficulty and burden, as I said. It wasn't just one thing or another. In fact, we know that he had these bouts with what would be considered probably some form of just spiritual oppression or depression. He called it Affektungen. I don't know if I'm pronouncing that right. Affektungen. And there's really no English equivalent. There's no way to really translate that word in English exactly right. Metaxas says this: already at Erfurt, the Affektungen that would famously affect him as a monk began to rear its hopeless head, causing him to wonder disturbingly about his own eternal fate and whether were he to die suddenly, would he be welcomed into the loving arms of God, or more likely be condemned to fall everlastingly into the taloned clutches of grotesque devils. So this is something that was really beginning, this sense of great torment was really beginning to affect him during his time at Erfurt and completing his master's degree of study. And in fact, the year before he graduated with his master's in 1504, he had a near-death experience. It's recounted like this. He had been traveling home to Mansfield for Easter when a student's sword that he carried, that many students in those days carried, somehow badly cut his leg, severing a main artery. The bleeding was so clearly life-threatening, and so Luther's traveling companion quickly ran to the nearby town to summon a doctor. During this time, Luther lay alone in the field, desperately applying pressure with his hand to staunch the bleeding, wondering whether he would survive that afternoon. He well knew that he could die there, and then so he cried out to St. Mary in prayer, begging her to spare his life. This is before the cry to St. Anne and the thunderbolt. This is over a year before that. So he cries out to St. Mary. A doctor eventually comes and sews up the wound. but apparently didn't do a very good job, and the wound at that night reopened and began to bleed again. So he cried out to Mary again to spare him, and again he survived, but couldn't walk for a long time after that. But it affected him, in other words. So if you fear death and you have a sense of uncertainty about the afterlife, and you know that you're unholy, and you know that you're sinful, and you know that you're going to stand before a holy and majestic God, it's tormenting. It's tormenting. And yet all this in the context of a school in which there's these regimented devotions, this significant amount of time and devotional reading and study and prayer. On and on and on it goes. It just goes to show you that you can do a lot of that stuff and be as far from grace as you can possibly imagine. The chasm can be enormous, eternal, in fact. And that's kind of where he was. In fact, a year later, in April of 1505, and then a little bit later after that, two Erfurt lawyers died of the plague that had reemerged. And so that struck him. So he had this near-death experience himself, and then these two lawyers that had pursued the same course of study that he had pursued, they died of the plague. And in fact, Luther said that the last words of both of these lawyers had been, "Oh, that I had become a monk." So, again, that's the commitment that he ultimately makes. But there was this belief that you had to do something else. There was something more that would make the difference, that would flip the switch. If I just would have not pursued these secular course of study in law, if I just would have become a monk, then maybe I would not be feeling the torment that I feel right now facing death and at death's door with the plague. I mean, that was kind of the idea. That was the atmosphere. That was the ethos of the time. So these are just some experiences and some people and some influences that were all leading up to even before these grand events that we mentioned at the very beginning. But lightning does actually strike. So let me read you the account of that, and we'll close with that, and we'll finish up with this next week. Listen to this account of this lightning striking event. Hard by some fields outside the village of Stotterheim, there is a humble red monolith set on end, standing as a memorial to what happened at that spot on the second day of July, 1505. It was on that humid summer day that Martin Luther, fatigued from the very long journey and only 6 miles from Erfurt, found himself overwhelmed by a sudden, tremendous thunderstorm. He had been riding a horse, but it seemed that at this juncture he dismounted. The falling rivers of water and the moaning wind and the deafening cracks of thunder and lightning around his head caused him to tremble with the realization that at any moment, like so many others caught in storms like this, he might instantly be summoned from this life. In those moments, death and hell were suddenly horribly palpable. And the 21-year-old Martin Luther did not meet these grim possibilities with equanimity. The raging electrical storm so frightened him that all of the worst phantasms of his demise and damnation were before him, as real and more frightening than the raging storm, and the great weight of it all simply became unbearable. When an impossibly close blast of lightning struck, Luther collapsed to the wet ground in abject terror and cried out to Saint Anne, "Hilf du Sankt Anna," he shouted. "Help me, St. Anne." And then into the rain and wind, he shrieked the words that would change his life and the future of the world, words none heard but him. "Ich will ein Monk werden," he shouted. "I will become a monk." He shrieked them as a solemn vow, meaning that if St. Anne helped him now, helped him to survive this terror, he would repay her great mercy by devoting the rest of his born days to being a man of God, to taking holy orders, and forever leaving the world he had lived until that time. Luther did not die that day outside Stotterheim. He arose from the soaked ground to stagger his final miles to Erfurt and his law studies, but what happened there would not be forgotten. And from there he changes course dramatically and then begins to torture himself as a monk before the light shines. So we'll talk about that next week. Any questions or comments before we pray and are dismissed?